This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. Book 2, The Arrival. 8. Firmness is discovered in a gentle heart. On that evening, the interior of Bloom's End, though cosy and comfortable, had been rather silent. Tim Yeobright was not at home. Since the Christmas party, he had gone on a few days' visit to a friend about 10 miles off. The shadowy form seen by Van to part from Wild Eve in the porch and quickly withdraw into the house was Thomasin's. On entering, she threw down a cloak which had been carelessly wrapped round her and came forward to the light where Mrs. Yeobright sat at her work table, drawn up within the settle so that part of it projected into the chimney corner. "I don't like your going out after dark alone, Tamsin," said her aunt quietly, without looking up from her work. "I've only just been outside the door." "Well?" inquired Mrs. Yeobright, struck by a change in the tone of Thomasin's voice and observing her. Thomasin's cheek was flushed to a pitch far beyond that which it had reached before her troubles, and her eyes glittered. "'Twas he who knocked," she said. "I thought as much." "He wishes the marriage to be at once."
"Indeed.
What, is he anxious?" Mrs. Yeobright directed a searching look upon her niece. "Why did not Mr. Wildeve come in?"
"He did not wish to. You are not friends with him, he says. He would like the wedding to be the day after tomorrow, quite privately, at the church of his parish, not at ours."
"Oh, and what did you say?"
"I agreed to it," Thomasin answered firmly. "I am a practical woman now. I don't believe in hearts at all. I would marry him under any circumstances, since Clem's letter."
A letter was lying on Mrs. Yeobright's workbasket, and at Thomasin's words her aunt reopened it and silently read for the 10th time that day. "What is the meaning of this silly story that people are circulating about Thomasin and Mr. Wildeve? I should call such a scandal humiliating if there was the least chance of its being true. How could such a gross falsehood have arisen? It is said that one should go abroad to hear news of home, and I appear to have done it. Of course, I contradict the tale everywhere, but it is very vexing, and I wonder how it could have originated. It is too ridiculous that such a girl as Thomasin could so mortify us as to get jilted on the wedding day. What has she done?"
"Yes," Mrs. Yeobright said, sadly putting down the letter. "If you think you can marry him, do so. And since Mr. Wildeve wishes it to be unceremonious, let it be that, too. I can do nothing. It's all in your own hands now. My power over your welfare came to an end when you left this house to go with him to Anglebury." She continued, half in bitterness, "I may almost ask, why do you consult me in the matter at all? If you'd gone and married him without saying a word to me, I could hardly have been angry, simply because, poor girl, you can't do a better thing."
"Don't say that and dishearten me."
"Ah, you're right. I will not."
"I do not plead for him, aunt. Human nature is weak, and I am not a blind woman to insist that he is perfect. I did think so, but I don't now. But I know my course. And you know that I know it. I hope for the best."
"And so do I, and we will both continue to," said Mrs. Yeobright, rising and kissing her.
"Then the wedding, if it comes off, will be on the morning of the very day Clem comes home?"
"Yes, I decided that it ought to be over before he came. After that, you can look him in the face, and so can I. Our concealments will matter nothing.
Mrs. Yeobright moved her head in thoughtful assent, and presently said,
Do you wish me to give you away?
I'm willing to undertake that, you know, if you wish, as I was last time.
After once forbidding the banns, I think I can do no less.
I don't think I will ask you to come, said Thomason, reluctantly, but with decision.
It would be unpleasant, I'm almost sure.
Better let there be only strangers present, and none of my relations at all. I would rather have it so.
I do not wish to do anything which may touch your credit, and I feel that I should be uncomfortable if you were there, after what has passed.
I am only your niece, and there is no necessity why you should concern yourself more about me.
Well, he has beaten us, her aunt said. It really seems as if he had been playing with you in this way, in revenge for my humbling him as I did by standing up against him at first.
Oh, no, aunt, murmured Thomason.
They said no more on the subject then. Diggory Venn's knock came soon after, and Mrs. Yeobright, on returning from her interview with him in the porch, carelessly observed,
Another lover has come to ask for you.
No? Yes, that queer young man Venn.
Asks to pay his addresses to me?
Yes, and I told him he was too late.
Thomason looked silently into the candle flame.
Poor Diggory, she said,
and then aroused herself to other things. The next day was passed in mere mechanical deeds of preparation, both the women being anxious to immerse themselves in these to escape the emotional aspect of the situation. Some wearing apparel and other articles were collected anew for Thomason, and remarks on domestic details were frequently made so as to obscure any inner misgivings about her future as Wild Eve's wife. The appointed morning came. The arrangement with Wild Eve was that he should meet her at the church to guard against any unpleasant curiosity which might have affected them had they been seen walking off together in the usual country way. Aunt and niece stood together in the bedroom where the bride was dressing. The sun, where it could catch it, made a mirror of Thomason's hair, which she always wore braided. It was braided according to a calendric system. The more important the day, the more numerous the strands in the braid. On ordinary working days, she braided it in threes. On ordinary Sundays, in fours. At maypolings, gypsyings, and the like, she braided it in fives. Years ago, she had said that when she married, she would braid it in sevens. She had braided it in sevens today.
I've been thinking that I will wear my blue silk after all, she said. It is my wedding day, even though there may be something sad about the time. I mean, she added, anxious to correct any wrong impression, not sad in itself, but in its having had great disappointment and trouble before it.
Mrs. Yeobright breathed in a way which may have been called a sigh.
Oh, I almost wish Clem had been at home, she said.
Of course you chose the time because of his absence.
Partly. I have felt that I acted unfairly to him in not telling him all. But as it was done not to grieve him, I thought I would carry out the plan to its end and tell the whole story when the sky was clear.
You're a practical little woman, said Mrs. Yeobright, smiling.
I wish you and he...
No, I don't wish anything. There, it's 9 o'clock, she interrupted, hearing a whiz and a dinging downstairs.
I told Damon I would leave at 9,
said Thomason, hastening out of the room. Her aunt followed. When Thomason was going up the little walk from the door to the wicket gate,
Mrs. Yeobright looked reluctantly at her and said, "It's a shame to let you go alone."
"It's necessary," said Thomasin.
"At any rate," added her aunt with forced cheerfulness, "I shall call upon you this afternoon and bring the cape with me. If Clem has returned by that time, he will perhaps come too. I wish to show Mr. Wildeve that I bear him no ill will. Let the past be forgotten."
"Well, God bless you. There, I don't believe in old superstitions, but I'll do it."
She threw a slipper at the retreating figure of the girl, who turned, smiled, and went on again. A few steps farther, and she looked back.
Did you call me aunt?"
she tremulously inquired.
"Goodbye."
Moved by an uncontrollable feeling, as she looked upon Mrs. Yeobright's worn, wet face, she ran back when her aunt came forward, and they met again.
"Oh, Tansy," said the elder, weeping, "I don't like to let you go." I'm,
Thomasin began, giving way likewise. But quelling her grief, she said,
"Goodbye,"
again, and went on. Then Mrs. Yeobright saw a little figure wending its way between the scratching furze bushes and diminishing far up the valley, a pale blue spot in a vast field of neutral brown, solitary and undefended except by the power of her own hope. But the worst feature in the case was one which did not appear in the landscape. It was the man. The hour chosen for the ceremony by Thomasin and Wildeve had been so timed as to enable her to escape the awkwardness of meeting her cousin Clem, who was returning the same morning. To own to the partial truth of what he had heard would be distressing, as long as the humiliating position resulting from the event was unimproved. It was only after a second and successful journey to the altar that she could lift up her head and prove the failure of the first attempt a pure accident. She had not been gone from Bloom's End more than half an hour when Yeobright came by the meads from the other direction and entered the house. "I had an early breakfast," he said to his mother after greeting her. "Now I could eat a little more." They sat down to the repeated meal, and he went on, in a low, anxious voice, apparently imagining that Thomasin had not yet come downstairs. "What's this I've heard about Thomasin and Mr. Wildeve?"
"It is true in many points," said Mrs. Yeobright quietly.
"But it is all right now, I hope." She looked at the clock.
"True?"
"Thomasin is gone to him today." Clem pushed away his breakfast.
"Then there is a scandal of some sort, and that's what's the matter with Thomasin.
Was it this that made her ill?"
"Yes. Not a scandal. A misfortune."
"I will tell you all about it, Clem. You must not be angry, but you must listen. And you'll find that what we have done has been done for the best." She then told him the circumstances. All that he had known of the affair before he returned from Paris was that there had existed an attachment between Thomasin and Wildeve, which his mother had at first discountenanced, but had since, owing to the arguments of Thomasin, looked upon in a little more favourable light. When she, therefore, proceeded to explain all, he was greatly surprised and troubled.
"And she determined that the wedding should be over before you came back," said Mrs. Yeobright,
"that there might be no chance of her meeting you and having a very painful time of it. That's why she has gone to him. They have arranged to be married this morning."
"But I can't understand it," said Yeobright, rising. "It is so unlike her. I can see why you did not write to me after her unfortunate return home. But why didn't you let me know when the wedding was going to be, the first time?"
"Well, I felt vexed with her just then. She seemed to me to be obstinate. and when I found that you were nothing in her mind, I vowed that she should be nothing in yours. I felt that she was only my niece after all. I told her she might marry, but that I should take no interest in it, and should not bother you about it either. It wouldn't have been bothering me. Mother, you did wrong. I thought it might disturb you in your business, and that you might throw up your situation, or injure your prospects in some way because of it. So I said nothing. Of course, if they had married at that time in a proper manner, I should have told you at once. Tamsin actually being married while we're sitting here? Yes, unless some accident happens again as it did the first time. It may, considering he's the same man. Yes, and I believe it will. Was it right to let her go? Suppose Wildeed is really a bad fella. Then he won't come, and she'll come home again. You should have looked more into it. It's useless to say that, his mother answered with an impatient look of sorrow. You don't know how bad it's been here with us all these weeks, Clem. You don't know what a mortification anything of that sort is to a woman. You don't know the sleepless nights we've had in this house, and the almost bitter words that have passed between us since that 5th of November. I hope never to pass 7 such weeks again. Tamsin has not gone outside the door, and I've been ashamed to look anybody in the face. And now you blame me for letting her do the only thing that can be done to set that trouble straight. No, he said slowly. Upon the whole, I don't blame you. But just consider how sudden it seems to me. Here was I knowing nothing, and then I'm told all at once that Tamsin is gone to be married. Well, I suppose there was nothing better to do. You know, Mother, he continued after a moment or two, looking suddenly interested in his own past history, I once thought of Tamsin as a sweetheart. Yes, I did. How odd boys are. And when I came home and saw her this time, she seemed so much more affectionate than usual that I was quite reminded of those days, particularly on the night of the party when she was unwell. We had the party just the same. Was not that rather cruel to her? It made no difference. I had arranged to give one, and it was not worthwhile to make more gloom than necessary. To begin by shutting ourselves up and telling you of Tamsin's misfortunes would have been a poor sort of welcome. Clem remained thinking. I almost wish you had not had that party, he said, and for other reasons. But I'll tell you in a day or two. We must think of Tamsin now. They lapsed into silence. I tell you what, said Yeobright again, in a tone which showed some slumbering feeling still. I don't think it kind to Tamsin to let her be married like this, and neither of us there to keep up her spirits or care a bit about her. She hasn't disgraced herself or done anything to deserve that. It is bad enough that the wedding should be so hurried and unceremonious, without our keeping away from it in addition. Upon my soul, 'tis almost a shame. I'll go. Oh, it's over by this time, said his mother with a sigh. Unless they were late or he, then I shall be soon enough to see them come out. I don't quite like your keeping me in ignorance, Mother, after all. Really, I half hope he has failed to meet her. And ruined her character? Nonsense, that wouldn't ruin Thomasin. He took up his hat and hastily left the house. Mrs. Yeobright looked rather unhappy, and sat still deep in thought. But she was not long left alone. A few minutes later, Clem came back again, and in his company came Diggory Venn. I find there isn't time for me to get there, said Clem. Is she married? Mrs. Yeobright inquired, turning to the Reddleman, a face in which a strange strife of wishes for and against was apparent. Venn bowed.
She is, ma'am.
How strange it sounds, murmured Klim. And he didn't disappoint her this time, said Mrs. Yeobright.
He did not.
And there is now no slight on her name. I was hastening the fart to tell you at once, as I saw you were not there.
How came you to be there? How did you know it? She asked.
I've been in that neighborhood for some time, and I saw them go in, said the Riddleman. Wild Eve came up to the door punctual as the clock. I didn't expect it of him. He did not add, as he might have added, that how he came to be in that neighborhood was not by accident. That since Wild Eve's resumption of his right to Thomasin, Venn, with the thoroughness which was part of his character, had determined to see the end of the episode.
Who was there? Said Mrs. Yeobright.
Nobody, hardly. I stood right out of the way, and she did not see me. The Riddleman spoke huskily and looked into the garden.
Who gave her away?
Miss Vi.
How very remarkable, Miss Vi.
It is to be considered an honor, I suppose.
Who's Miss Vi? Said Klim.
Captain Vi's granddaughter, of Mistover Nab.
A proud girl from Budmouth, said Mrs. Yeobright. One not much to my liking. People say she's a witch, but of course that's absurd.
The Riddleman kept to himself his acquaintance with that fair personage, and also that Eustacia was there because he went to fetch her, in accordance with a promise he had given as soon as he learned that the marriage was to take place. He merely said, in continuation of the story, I was sitting on the churchyard wall when they came up, one from one way, the other from the other, and Miss Vi was walking thereabouts, looking at the headstones. As soon as they had gone in, I went to the door, feeling I should like to see it, as I knew her so well. I pulled off my boots because they were so noisy, and went up into the gallery. I saw then that the parson and clerk were already there.
How came Miss Vi to have anything to do with it, if she was only on a walk that way?
Well, because there was nobody else. She had gone into the church just before me, not into the gallery. The parson looked round before beginning, and as she was the only one near, he beckoned to her, and she went up to the rails. After that, when it came to signing the book, she pushed up her veil and signed, and Tamsin seemed to thank her for her kindness. The Riddleman told the tale thoughtfully, for there lingered upon his vision the changing colour of Wild Eve, when Eustacia lifted the thick veil which had concealed her from recognition, and looked calmly into his face.
And then, said Diggory sadly, I came away,
for her history as Tamsin Yeobright was over.
I offered to go, said Mrs. Yeobright regretfully, but she said it was not necessary.
Well, 'tis no matter, said the Riddleman. The thing is done at last, as it was meant to be at first, and God send her happiness. Now I'll wish you good morning. He placed his cap on his head and went out. From that instant of leaving Mrs. Yeobright's door, the Riddleman was seen no more in or about Egdon Heath for a space of many months. He vanished entirely. The nook among the brambles where his van had been standing was as vacant as ever the next morning, and scarcely a sign remained to show that he had been there, excepting a few straws and a little redness on the turf, which was washed away by the next storm of rain. The report that Diggory had brought of the wedding, correct as far as it went, was deficient in one significant particular, which had escaped him through his being at some distance back in the church. When Thomasin was tremblingly engaged in signing her name, Wild Eve had flung towards Eustacia a glance that said, plainly, I have punished you now. She had replied in a low tone, and he little thought how truly. You mistake. It gives me sincerest pleasure to see her, your wife, today. End of chapter 8, end of book 2.